Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome back. This is Dale Graham and welcome to Masonic Home Companion. I hope you've all had an enjoyable week. I'm sitting here in southern Ontario. Fabulous weather. Doesn't get any better than this. But of course, you could always say, life is what you make of it. Today we're going to continue some of the discussions about the things that seem to distract us and put us off task. Perhaps we can add to the discussion that's going on out there. I want to introduce a fellow, the idea of a fellow to you. I think you'll find this is an interesting fellow, and I don't know if you can tell who he is. I'll just read a paragraph about this man, and I think we all like to have some moment of inspiration even today. Forget Lance Armstrong and his tidy 7 victories in the Tour de France. Between 1961 and 1978, Eddie the Cannibal Merckx won 525 races, including 5 Tour de France, 4 Giro d'Italia, and 3 world championships. He began his season in February and ended in October. Unlike Armstrong, Merckx never saved himself for a particular event. If he went 4 days without winning a race, he would become depressed and say to his trainer, "I haven't won anything for a while." Son of a grocer in a Brussels suburb, Eddie was a shy, sensitive boy. In the closed shop of Flemish riders, he was an outsider, a Flemish boy who had grown up speaking French. This is why he later became an icon of Belgian national unity and was often seen knocking back a few beers with his friend, King Baudouin I. Even ignoring the syringe-wielding Saunier who suffered their protégés with amphetamines, a subject almost totally absent from a new biography out, the cycling establishment was as ruthless as a dog-fighting cartel. In 1964, young Eddie was diagnosed with a heart defect and dropped from the Belgian team competing in the World Road Championships. The problem, it turned out, was not his heart, but corrupt selectors and dodgy doctors. His solution was to win races so convincingly that no one would dare to leave him out. Merckx's style of racing could be summed up in 2 rules. Accelerate. Then keep going and don't look back. He would escape from the peloton with 100 kilometers to go, powering off into the sleet and the wind, elbows flailing with the effort, and not to be seen again until the podium. Sometimes the gap was so huge that the rider who came in second thought he'd won the race. In the Marseille stage of the 1971 Tour de France, spectators and camera crews were eating lunch, looking forward to the afternoon's entertainment, when the cannibal shot across the deserted finish line 90 minutes ahead of schedule. This needless annihilation of his rivals, according to an author, was a result of Merck's insecurity. He could never be absolutely certain that the gap was big enough, a puncture, a stray dog. Any microscopic event might prevent a victory. To a fan who follows his favorite's nail-biting defense of a 10-second lead, this might sound perfectly sensible. But in a highly unusual professional cycling, it is striking. People who race down icy mountain roads at 110 kilometers with a broken collarbone tend not to be warriors. He left nothing to chance. He was one of the first riders to take a scientific approach to racing. In those days, it didn't take much to be seen as a velocipedal Einstein. Even today, there are professional cyclists who couldn't change an inner tube or realign a brake block. Merckx was widely admired for carrying his own Allen key to make small adjustments to the height of his saddle. He once dismantled a bicycle just to find out how many components it had. 1,125. I just wondered if that type of history gives any of us a moment of inspiration. Particularly when he was diagnosed with a heart disease and dropped from a team because of what? He didn't fit in. But how many of us? I'd like to hope that each one of you and I would remember this type of story and will remember it in the moment when we need it, when it becomes important to us to be able to reach deeper and prevail. You can imagine, can't you, the deadening feeling inside of him when he knew this wasn't true. And his response was to kick it up a notch. Now, if that doesn't inspire something inside of each one of us, there's something wrong. Well, perhaps your life is much more convenient and there is no need for inspiration. I have no doubt you're all self-actuated fellows. So today I want to talk to you a little bit about this sense of paradise that we often are struggling to achieve. And I want to frame what we're going to hear in the next, what we're going to talk about in the next hour or so, as an answer to that plaguing question. When we look at the potential of the order, we are continually conflict-based. Something's wrong, in other words. We never seem to be able to come up with a solution. Now, get comfortable in your big armchairs with your favorite beverage beside you, because I'm going to reveal the secret. This has nothing to do with that cloying little book that was out a few years ago. Secret is, there's nothing wrong with the order. Nothing wrong with it. Come on, we have to get it. We're not getting it. The order is what it is. Oh my, there's got to be something wrong. Come on, put your hand up. Admit it. You're sitting there saying, you're wrong. You're blowing smoke again, Graham. I like to think it would be that simple. There's nothing wrong with the order. It's been around a lot longer than you and I. And that's not necessarily something to belittle. I wonder, and put this out to you, how long can we continue to tolerate existing as a subtext to the main event? How long? We get distracted by so much of the pettiness. And yes, there's a pettiness around us, but so what? We didn't invent it. We can easily get sidetracked by something that's easier for us to get our minds around. oh, we have to have something that we can see. Well, let's look at a ledger book. Let's look at bills and finances, and let's look at the perception of, let's be thin-skinned. And if I didn't get the message in the form I wanted and the time I wanted, then that justifies my contempt for you. Ha ha. Also redefines who we are as individuals. Remarkable. And I guess I can be somewhat serious in saying to you that this is easier. It's easier to be distracted. It's easier to take offense. And I think it's the 110th proverb that's been on my mind lately. I don't tolerate somebody mocking me, and either should you. I don't know that. But it's easier to deal with that. It's easier to deal with finance. It's easier to deal with, you know, buffoonery. Let's make it a joke. Than it is to deal with the esoteric, the metaphysics, the things that aren't tangible. And I think we can all agree to that. What's on our minds? What plagues our conscience? What demons are on your shoulders? Well, to truth be known, they're not altogether that extreme. We all have our own versions of it. Well, do we feel the intimacy and the trust that we need in order to deal with them? Not perhaps face to face, of course. Leave that for the therapist coach. Or the close conversation with a dear friend. But it's in that atmosphere. It's in that atmosphere where we begin to find questions, answers to questions, sorry. So I ask you, help me out here. Have I become too intolerant of the excesses and the indulgences afforded to a once select order that is now reinvented as a populist fanciful club? Haha. I wrote that some time ago. We seem to have languished far too long knowing what is needed to be done, but unwilling to act. Let's roll up our sleeves a little bit and see what we can get into. I'm going to give you a word. Now, this is the word of the week. And I hope right now you're all experiencing this word. This is a noun, and it's called lubberland. It was originally used in the late 16th century, and it refers to a mythical paradise reserved for those who are lazy. Lubberland. So temporarily, be lazy. This is an obscure word. Try and work that one into a conversation. Lubberland. Yes, we're coming up to the solstice. I hope you're paying some attention to the event. It's important. It was important to our ancients, and it's important because it represents an extreme. The longest, where we are, we're exposed to the greatest amount of sunlight. So, I want to talk to you a little bit about, we'll get into a bit of Egyptian symbolism, not as much as I did previously. But I want to set up, later we'll talk more about the moral development of Montaigne, that 16th century little cad. But I want to, give you an illustration of Stoicism. I mean, you remember earlier in one of the shows I talked about, the skeptic and Epicurean and the Stoic. But today I want to emphasize more of this Stoicism, and that'll become a little evident to you, a little more evident why I'm doing that a little later. The ethical question that concerned the Stoics in the 4th century BC was how to react to the prevailing sense of fatalism that came from living in a tightly controlled empire. Now, of course, apply this all over the place as we go along. They could not change much of anything in their daily lives, so they decided to change their attitude toward life itself. It was the only personal control they had left. What the Stoics came up with was a strategy of emotional disengagement from life. They called their attitude apatheia, or apathy. And for the Stoics, apathy was a virtue, which made them a barrel of laughs at the local taverna. The Stoics were willing to sacrifice some kinds of happiness. Sex, drugs, and Dionysian hip-hop, I'm sure, in order to afford the unhappiness brought on by their passions. STDs, hangovers, bad rhymes. They acted only from reason, never from passion, and therefore considered themselves the only truly happy people, which is to say they were unhappy. Here's a little example. Coopers were shown into the dentist's office, where Mr. Cooper made it clear he was in a big hurry. No fancy stuff, Doc, he ordered. No gas, no needles, or any of that stuff. Just pull the tooth out and get it over with. I wish more of my patients were as stoic as you, said the dentist admiringly. Now, which tooth is it? Mr. Cooper turned to his wife. Open your mouth, honey. I love that. Stoicism has its place, you have to admit. G.K. Chesterton once wrote, the word good has many meanings. For example, if a man were to shoot his mother at a range of 500 yards, I should call him a good shot, but not necessarily a good man. It's the qualifier necessarily that shows Chesterton possessed a truly philosophical mind. Next time I'm going to want to get into, we should probably get into utilitarianism, so you have a better sense of what all this nonsense, you know. Every time there's an American president, they all kind of gather up their skirts and go shrieking away. We don't want any of that socialism. They have no clue what they're talking about. Like, so I'll make it materialism and the capitalist way. Gee, that drum's been beaten a few times too many lately, wouldn't you say? Wonder what they're going to come up with next. Now, this may have a little more traction than some of the other things that we're talking about lately in terms of Egyptian symbolism and the context of symbolism. We'll go on with this just a little bit today. The North American reader should be aware that the term corn is used in England. Oh, sorry. Here I go again. Sorry, I apologize to the listeners. This comes from the Mysteries of Freemasonry, an exposition of the religious dogmas and customs of the ancient Egyptians. So all of you cowans out there, get out your pencils. Go down to the library and dig out this book. Or Google it. The mystery is, you know, you want to be part of the order, be part of the order. You want to learn something about moral development? By all means. There is no secret about that. It's a struggle for all of us. Stretch it out here a bit. This is not an organization of aggression. And take in a bit of this. The American reader should be aware, North American reader, that the term corn is used in England as a generic term for all seeds that grow in ears. The French word here translated corn is blé, which signifies grain, wheat. Wheat, as it ripens, puts on a reddish hue, which is not the case with Indian corn, although red ears are sometimes found among it. Grain, in English, seems the most proper term for the genus of the different species. In Masonic lodges, the master is stationed in the east, representing Osiris, the sun, and the senior warden in the west, representing Isis, or Virgo, the sign of harvest. His duty is to pay the craft their wages, which alludes metaphorically to the reward the husbandman receives in the produce of his labor. Husbandman, as in what we would know as a rancher or farmer, somebody that takes care of livestock. When the sun arrives, he receives payment when the sun arrives at its sign. This is indicated by a painting representing a sheaf of wheat, which is hung back of his officer's chair. Now, the password of the fellow craft at this station to entitle him to pay is blah, blah, blah. Those of you who know remember what it is. And if you old boys haven't been in a fellow craft lodge, you probably have forgotten, may need a little refresher. I am not going to spell it here. Go and ask one of your friends, one of your Masonic brothers. Can anything more conclusively point out the astronomical cast of Freemasonry? It must have been a remote period when the Egyptian harvest occurred, as above stated, during the passage of the sun, either under the sign of the ram or the bull. Volney, in his travels to Egypt and Syria, observes, as the sun approaches the Tropic of Capricorn, the winds become variable and tempestuous. They most usually blow from the north, the northwest, and west, at which points they continue during the months of December, January, and February, which is the winter season in Egypt as well as it is for us. The vapor of the Mediterranean, condensed by the coldness of the atmosphere, descends in mists and rains. Now later we'll get into this a little bit more, but that paragraph, that passage, is significant because we seem to have confused the idea of a corn with corn. Peppercorn with a seed. So we'll come back to that in a bit, just to give you a little bit of context. Now, as I promised, we'll share a little bit more about this fabulous, fabulous writer who was encouraged in the 16th century to continue to write because there was nothing else available at the time that gave information, conveyed information for men, presumed men, but not necessarily, about moral development. It was perhaps a little different for that period than it is for us, but the part that I want to talk to you about today is something that continues to influence us greatly, and I want us to sit back and at least be aware or have an opinion about this point of what influences us. We're pretty sure the media never lies to us. We're pretty sure what we read in the print media or on the radio or on television is verifiable, is valid. Is not affected by censorship. And then in the same breath, of course, we know that it is. Something that might be an obscure footnote for the day, if it seems to stimulate one of the more base desires of mankind, becomes front page news. And we're perfectly capable of ascribing guilt to the court through the court of public opinion. We're quite ready to do that. We'll try people before they've had their day, because we know they're guilty. And of course, now forensically, we know that our even eyewitness opinions and expressions are very, very inaccurate. We believe what we want to believe. Now, this was a time, remember, when there were extremes. Battles were extreme. Wars were major. And often had more to do with the dominance, proselytizing, I guess, of one group over another. The dominance being essential. And the struggle. In the day, we saw acts and atrocities committed by soldiers, committed by people toward their neighbors, not unlike what's happening today, triggered by a belief that the enemy is somehow the embodiment of the devil incarnate, or evil, or bad. So here we see that Montaigne, had a very unusual attitude toward war. We can say that he was mistaken, but it's hard to just dismiss him outright. Remember, we were talking previously about the battles going on between nationally France and England, Protestant, Catholic. Unfortunately, the one piece of common ground that really brought extreme Catholics close to extreme Protestants was hatred of politics, he says. The word itself was an accusation of godlessness. These were people who paid attention only to political solutions, not to the state of their souls. They were men of masks, deceivers. He wears the skin of a lamb, wrote one contemporary of a typical politic, but nevertheless is a raging wolf. Unlike real Protestants, they tried to pass on something they were not. And since they were so clever and intellectual, they did not have the excuse of being innocent victims of the devil's deception. Ah, yes, the embodiment of everything evil. We have to really come up with a cartoon of it to make it real for us. Huh? Montaigne's association with the politics gave him a good reason to emphasize his openness and honesty, as well as his Catholic orthodoxy. Though, of course, claiming to be honest is exactly what a wolf in sheep's clothing would do. Leguists, now go and Google this one, L-E-A-G-U-I-S-T-S, S-T-S, Leguists, go and Google that one. They accused politics of untrustworthiness, but politics in turn accused Leguists of abandoning themselves to their passions and losing their judgment. How strange, reflected Montaigne, that Christianity should often lead to violent excess and thence to destruction and pain. And he says, our zeal does wonders when it is seconding our leaning towards hatred, cruelty, ambition, avarice, detraction, rebellion. Our zeal is against the grain toward goodness, benignity, moderation. Unless, as by a miracle, some rare nature bears it, it will neither walk nor fly. Remember, he's writing in the 16th century. Apply what you want to your own context today, to our context today. There is no hostility, he writes, that exceeds Christian hostility. He even wrote at one point, in place of the figure of the burning-eyed Christian zealot, he preferred to contemplate that of the Stoic sage, a person who behaves morally, moderates his emotions, exercises good judgment, and knows how to live. There was indeed much of Stoic philosophy in the politics. They did not urge revolution or regicide, but recommended acceptance of life as it is, on the Stoic principle of amor fati, or love of fate. They also promoted the Stoic sense of continuity, the belief that the world would probably continue to cycle through episodes of decay and rejuvenation rather than accelerating into a one-directional rush towards the end. While the religious parties imagined the armies of Armageddon assembling in the sky, the politiques suspected that sooner or later everything would calm down and people would come back to their senses. In millenarian times, they were the only people systematically to shift their perspective and think ahead to a time when the troubles would have become history, and to plan exactly how to build this future world. Montaigne's Stoic side led him to downplay the wars to an astonishing extent in his readings. Biographers have invariably made much of his experience of war. and with good reason. It did affect his life profoundly. Some critics have based whole readings of Montaigne on the wars. But after studying any such book, it can come as a surprise to turn back to the essays and find Montaigne saying things like, "I am amazed to see our wars so gentle and mild. And it will be a lot if 100 years from now people remember in a general way that in our time there were civil wars in France. Those living through the present assume that things are worse than they are," he says, "because they cannot escape their local perspective." Whoever considers, as in a painting, the great picture of our Mother Nature in her full majesty, whoever reads such universal and constant variety in her face, whoever finds himself there, and not merely himself, but a whole kingdom, as a dot made with a very fine brush, that man alone estimates things according to their true proportions. How important is it? Control your motion. Montaigne reminded his contemporaries of the old Stoic lesson. To avoid feeling swamped by a difficult situation, try imagining your world from different angles or at different scales of significance. This is what the ancients did when they looked down on their troubles from above, as upon a commotion in an ant colony. Astrologers now warn of great and imminent alterations and mutations, writes Montaigne, but they forget the simple fact that however bad things are, most of life goes on undisturbed. "I do not despair about it," he added lightly. Admittedly, Montaigne was lucky. The wars ruined his harvest, made him fear being murdered in his bed, and forced him to take part in political activities he would have preferred to avoid. They would land him in even greater troubles in the 1580s when the war entered its last and most desperate phase. But no one could claim that he was badly scarred by these experiences. And if he ever took up arms himself, he says nothing about it in the essays. In short, he had a good war. Yet that would not have stopped most people from indulging in lamentation. Indulging. Lamentation. And Montaigne was right. Life did go on. The St. Bartholomew's massacres, terrible as they were, gave way to years of inconclusive individual suffering, rather than heralding the end of the world. The Antichrist did not come. Generation followed generation until a time came when, as Montaigne predicted, many people had only the vaguest idea that his century's wars ever took place. This happened partly because of the work he and his fellow politiques did to restore sanity. Montaigne, affecting ease and comfort, contributed more to saving his country than his zealous contemporaries. Some of his work was directly political, but his greatest contribution was simply to stay out of it and write the essays. This, in the eyes of many, makes him a hero. Those who have adopted Montaigne in this role usually cast him as a hero of an unusual sort, the kind that resists all claim to heroism. Rare commodity these days, don't you think? Pick me, look at me. Few revere him for doing great public deeds, although he did accomplish some noteworthy things in his later life. More often, he is admired for his stubborn assistance on maintaining normality in extraordinary circumstance, and his refusal to compromise his independence. Many contemporaries saw him in this light. The great Stoic political thinker Justus Lipsius told him to keep writing because people needed his example to follow. Long after the 16th century Stoic Montaigne was forgotten, readers in troubled times continue to think of him as a role model. His essays offer practical wisdom on questions such as how to face up to intimidation and how to reconcile the conflicting demands of openness and security. I'm thinking pretty profound. When you sat down today in your big comfortable chair, was a century of war from his period on your mind, or was it forgotten as he had predicted? Was the suffering lingering, or is it forgotten, put in a different context, as this man suggested? Just as you could seek mercy from an enemy forthrightly without compromising yourself, or defend your property by electing to leave it undefended, so you could get through an inhumane war by remaining human. This message in Montaigne would have a particular appeal to 20th century readers who lived through wars, or through fascists, or communist dictatorships. In such times, it could seem that the structure of civilized society had collapsed, and that nothing would ever be the same. Montaigne was at his most assuring when he provided the least sympathy for this feeling, when he reminded the reader that in the end, normality comes back and perspectives shift again. What do we do with this? Do we debate this point? We'll come back. Of course we will. That's a lot to take in. It's a lot to take in. But remember, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, all life is an experiment. The more experiments you make, the better. The man who dares to waste 1 hour of time has not discovered the value of life. That's our friend Chuck Darwin again. Thanks, Charles. Glad you didn't become a lawyer. He had to stand up to his daddy, but his grandfather was the real interesting one. Don't go around saying the world owes you a living. The world owes you nothing. It was here first. Well, where did Mark Twain get that one? Let me talk to you a little bit about history, but just to spice this one, I want you to have in the back of your nostrils this one. Every man dies, not every man really lives. Every man dies. Remember, we're talking about a history of the world in six classes. This is a book by the author of the Victorian Internet and the other book he wrote called The Turk. Interesting stuff. This is Tom Standage. This is what you get, you know, when you start to look at European literature. You start to find these things written and discover things that are cool. Redefine history besides the usual plaudits about conquest. There's far, far more going on. Far more. And the importance of it, if we look at Montaigne intellectually, how do we... the bunch that, if you're not with them, you're behind them, stand in front of them, kind of bumper sticker mentality, probably you're going to have a hard time with this one, but hey, nobody said this was easy. Every creature is better alive than dead. Men and moose and pine trees, and he who understands it's all right, a right will rather preserve its life than destroy it. Thank you, Henry David Thoreau. Rich guy. Rich kid. He tried to make sense out of the meaning of it all and our place in nature. if you haven't read Walden, I suggest you do it. It's really interesting. And remember that this was a fellow that had the the check written by his inheritance. Turned away from that to make a difference. I want to talk. We've talked about coffee and beer and wine. And we talked about spirits. And, of course, we're saving some of the best for the end here. This one is on tea. Better to be deprived of food for 3 days than of tea for one, says the Chinese proverb. With far-flung territory stretched around the world, the British Empire was famously described in 1773 by George Macartney, an imperial administrator, as this vast empire on which the sun never sets. So you've wondered where that quote came from? There it is. 1773, George Macartney, M.A.C. At its height, it encompassed a fifth of the world's surface and a quarter of its population. Despite the loss of its North American colonies following American independence, Britain expanded its sphere of influence dramatically from the mid-18th century, establishing control of India and Canada. Well, we'll have words about that, won't we? Establish control. Setting up new colonies in Australia and New Zealand. I'm sure they're pleased to hear this bit of history. And displacing the Dutch to dominate European sea trade with the East. Now, settle back in your seats. We'll just go on and let the author have his way with that phrase. Man. But that's not the point. Intertwined with Britain's emergence as the first global superpower was its pioneering adoption of a new system of manufacturing. Workers were brought into large factories where tireless labor-saving machines driven by steam engines amplified human skill and effort. A cluster of innovations collectively known today as the Industrial Revolution. Fantastic. It's a rough time, isn't it? Where are the Luddites when we need them? Let's go and break up those machines. That's the way we can stop. And by the way, if there is any Luddites out there that think that we should stop progress, turn off the show. You're going to be very unhappy with what you're going to hear next. This is coming from somebody that believes that progress is... It cannot and should not be stopped. It has always been in place. And you and I and everything coming behind us and everyone will make advantage of it, but it requires that we have perspective on what we are and who we are. Life's like that, eh? Life's always like that. Anyway. Linking these imperial and industrial expansions was a new drink. To Europeans, at least. That became associated with the English and remains so to this day. Tea provided the basis for the widening of European trade with the East. Profits from its trade helped to fund the advance into India of the British East India Company, the commercial organization that became Britain's de facto colonial government in the East. Having started as a luxury drink, tea trickled down to become the beverage of the working man. The fuel for the workers who operated the new machine-powered factories. If the sun never set on the British Empire, it was perpetually tea time somewhere at least. With its associated drinking rituals of genteel afternoon tea and the workers' tea break, tea perfectly matched Britain's self-image as a civilized, industrious power. How odd, then, that this quintessentially English drink initially had to be imported in great cost and effort from China, the vast and mysterious dominion on the other side of the world. and that the civilization and processing of tea were utter mysteries to its European drinkers. As far as they were concerned, the chests of tea leaves simply materialized on the dock in Canton. Tea might as well have come from Mars. Even so, tea somehow became a central part of British culture. The drink that already lubricated China's immense empire could then conquer vast new territories. The story of tea is the story of imperialism, industrialization, and world domination. According to Chinese tradition, the first cup of tea was brewed by the emperor Shen Nung, whose reign is traditionally dated 2737 to 2697 BCE. He was the second of China's legendary emperors and was credited with the inventions of agriculture and the plow, along with the discovery of medicinal herbs. That was 2737 to his death, 2697. Let's just get a little perspective on what was going on in Europe and what was going on in North America at that period. Is this the time when we should all close our eyes to get a grasp of what was going on where we are? And if you're in Canada, close your eyes. And what do you see? You see darkness. And that would have been about what was happening. Because I think at that time we were under about 8 miles of ice. Look up. Look all the way up. Yeah. He invented the plow. Was credited with it. Similarly, his predecessor, the first emperor, is said to have discovered fire, cooking, and music. Now, I love these legends. Legend has it that Shen Nung was boiling some water to drink, using some branches from a wild tea bush to fuel his fire when a gust of wind carried some of the plant's leaves into his pot. He found the resulting infusion a delicate and refreshing drink. Using some branches from a wild tea bush. He wrote later a medical treatment called the Pen Zhao on the medicinal uses of various herbs, in which he supposedly noted that an infusion of tea leaves quenches the thirst, lessens the desire for sleep, and gladdens and cheers the heart. Yet tea is not, in fact, such an ancient Chinese beverage. The story of Shen Nung is a far later invention. The earliest edition, dated in the Neo Han Dynasty 25 to 221 CE, makes no mention of tea. The reference of tea was added in the 7th century. Little scamps. Tea is an infusion of the dried leaves, buds, and flowers of an evergreen bush, Camellia sinensis, which seems to have evolved in the jungles of the eastern Himalayas on what is now the India-China border. In prehistoric times, people noticed the invigorating effect of chewing its leaves and the healing effect of rubbing them on wounds, practices that survived for thousands of years. Tea was also consumed in a medicinal gruel in southwest China, the chopped leaves being mixed with shallot, ginger, and other ingredients. Tribal peoples in what is now northern Thailand steamed or boiled the leaves and formed them into balls, then ate them with salt, oil, garlic, fat, and dried fish. So tea was a medicine and a foodstuff before it was a drink. How and when it spread into China isn't clear, but it seems to have been helped along by Buddhist monks. Adherents of the religion founded in India in the 6th century BCE. Both Buddhist and Taoist monks found that tea drinking was an invaluable aid to meditation, since it enhanced concentration and banished fatigue, qualities that are now known to be due to the presence of caffeine. Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, who lived in the 6th century BCE, believed that tea was an essential ingredient in the elixir of life. The earliest unambiguous Chinese reference to tea is from the 1st century, some 26th century after Shen Nung's supposed discovery. having started out as an obscure medicinal and religious beverage, tea first seems to have become a domestic drink in China around this time. A contemporary book, Working Rules of Servants, describes the proper way to buy and serve it. Tea had become so popular by the 4th century that it became necessary to begin the deliberate cultivation rather than simply harvesting the leaves from wild bushes. Tea spread throughout China and became the national beverage during the Tang Dynasty. That was 618 to 907 in the Common Era, a period that is regarded as a golden age in Chinese history. During this time, China was the largest, wealthiest, and most populous empire in the world. Its overall population tripled between 630 and 755 to exceed 50 million. And its capital, Shanghai, was the greatest metropolis on earth, home to around 2 million people. The city was a cultural magnet at a time when China was particularly open to outside influences. Trade thrived along the trade routes of the Silk Road and by sea with India, Japan, and Korea. Clothing, hairstyles, and the sport of polo were imported from Turkey and Persia. New foodstuffs from India, musical instruments and dances from Central Asia, along with wine in goatskin bags. China exported silk, tea, paper, and ceramics in return. Amid this diverse, dynamic, and cosmopolitan atmosphere, Chinese sculpture, painting, and poetry flourished. The prosperity of the period and the surge in population were helped along by the widespread adoption of the custom of tea drinking. Its powerful antiseptic properties meant it was safer to drink than previous beverages such as rice or millet beer, even if the water was not properly boiled during preparation. Modern research has found that the phenolics, or tannic acid, in tea can kill the bacteria that cause cholera, typhoid, and dysentery. Tea could be prepared quickly and easily from dried leaves and did not spoil like beer. It was, in effect, an efficient and convenient water purification technology that dramatically reduced the prevalence of waterborne diseases, reducing infant mortality and increasing longevity. Tea also had more visible economic impact, as the size and value of the tea trade, the China trade in tea grew during the 7th century. Let's come back to this in a few days. When I join you again, I hope it'll put a little bit of perspective on where we're going and what we're doing. Today we're talking about the influence, how we're influenced, what we can do about the influences, the need, the benefit of not losing our humanity in situations where it's easy to do. The Stoic has a solution that comes at a price. If we are to prevail in a way, it suggests that there are certain influences that you and I cannot control. The disagreements that lead to war, man's inhumanity to man, may well be in our nature. Perhaps that's part of the utopia that we all wish to achieve. We seem to be recalling history. China, thousands and thousands of years ago, were a highly civilized group of people. So I wonder if we take a look at the window of opportunity that's happening today. If what's happening in China is not a predictor of what our culture will be like 1,000 or 2,000 years from now. Will we be more ruthless to our fellow man? Will we be a threat? Will our culture be prepared to absorb and adapt? Or will we frivolously try to dominate, thoughtlessly try to incriminate? Will we be trying to discredit everything that is not us? I, for one, think that that's not likely to occur. Remember, we all have lessons to learn. Remember that life is hard. And perhaps that's why we seem to be focused on, at least in some aspects, trying to achieve a life of in utopia, where all people are self-aware. Within our order, we expect that all that we will achieve enlightenment, that all of us will. All of us have that potential. And perhaps that's our humanness, or is it that we're naive? If you and I think that we could not be brought into battle, we would say, well, perhaps somehow we're losing track of our humanness. But to aggrandize the degradation of humanity and to grandize the battle, no. It was there, but in 500 years, who will remember? Just like you and I, we're not bad people for forgetting. It's just that in this context, there are other things more important, like the concerns and decisions we have to make each and every day. What does this say about us and about the Masonic Order? It says a lot. It says a lot. It says that we need to have an opportunity to share some of these ideas. It also says that it's difficult because there's so much activity in a lodge. People that would wrinkle their nose. People that would act confused. People that would be quite upset by this type of conversation. But the conversation doesn't stop because of that. It just finds a path. It's like water, I guess. Finds a path. Just like we have. Just like we have. So, of course, over the next few days, we need to take Freemasonry outside the walls of Lodge and demonstrate through our behavior the things that are most sincere in our hearts. When you placed your hand on the volume and you made a solemn oath, you were making that to yourself. Where is the temple? It's you. Incomplete, it's you. You came into this incomplete. Roll up your sleeves. What do you think? Somebody's going to do it for you? Ha ha. Just remember, there's always somebody else that will inspire. Eddie Merckx inspired. He overcame a lot. He seemed to have done it right. I think that under those similar circumstances, we'll all be able to achieve that. So, you have a good time this week. Truly, I mean that. Commit as many acts of random kindness as you can to everybody. One feels inclined to say that the intention that man should be happy is not included in the plan of creation. Freud might have had a point. Aeschylus said in Agamemnon, call no man happy until he is dead. In the meantime, it's been a distinct pleasure. I look forward to seeing you. Come and join me next week. And here's a little Diana Krall. Say goodbye in the ways that I couldn't even possibly imagine. Bye.
every time we say goodbye, I die.